This is Audible.
The Way of Men by Jack Donovan. Narrated by Jack Donovan. Preface. I present this book to you without ego. It is not an advertisement for my own manhood, or a boast to flatter the men of my own tribe. This book is my answer to the question, what is masculinity? If men are a certain way, and there is a way to be manly, then what is the way of men? For decades, people have been talking about a crisis of masculinity. Our leaders have created a world in spite of men, a world that refuses to accept who men are and doesn't care what they want. Our world asks men to change for the better, but offers men less of value to them than their fathers and grandfathers had. The voices who speak for the future say that men must abandon their old way and find a new way. But what is that way? And where does it lead? As I came to understand the way of men, I became more concerned about where men are today and where they are headed. I wondered if there was a way for men to follow their own way into a future that belongs to men. That's the path of this book. My answers may not be the kind of answers that you want to hear, but they are the only answers that satisfied my inquiry. Jack Donovan, March 2012, Milwaukee, Oregon. The way of men is the way of the gang. When someone tells a man to be a man, they mean that there is a way to be a man. A man is not just a thing to be. It is also a way to be, a path to follow, and a way to walk. Some try to make manhood mean everything. Others believe that it means nothing at all. Being good at being a man can't mean everything, but it has always meant something. Most traditions have viewed masculinity and femininity as complementary opposites. It makes sense to say that masculinity is that which is least feminine, and femininity is that which is least masculine. But saying that doesn't tell us much about the way of men. Boys and girls don't pair off at birth and scurry off to a dank cave together. Humans have always been social animals. We live in cooperative groups. Our bodies sort us into groups of males or females. We interact socially as members of one group or the other. These groups aren't arbitrary or cultural. They're basic and biological. Males have to negotiate male and female groups as males. Males aren't simply reacting to females. We react to other males as males. Who we are has a lot to do with how we see ourselves in relationship to other males as members of the male group. A man is not merely a man, but a man among men. In a world of men. Being good at being a man has more to do with a man's ability to succeed with men and within groups of men than it does with a man's relationship to any woman or any group of women. When someone tells a man to be a man, they are telling him to be more like other men, more like the majority of men, and ideally, more like the men whom other men hold in high regard. Women believe that they can improve men by making masculinity about what women want from men. Men want women to want them, but female approval isn't the only thing men care about. When men compete against each other for status, they are competing for each other's approval. The women whom men find most desirable have historically been attracted to, or been claimed by, men who were feared or revered by other men. Female approval has regularly been a consequence of male approval. Masculinity is about being a man within a group of men. Above all things, masculinity is about what men want from each other. If the way of men seems confusing, it is only because there are so many different groups of men who want so many different things from men. Established men of wealth and power have always wanted men to believe that being a man was about duty and obedience, or that manhood could be proved by attaining wealth and power through established channels. Men of religion and ideology have always wanted men to believe that being a man was a spiritual or moral endeavor, and that manhood could be proved through various means of self-mastery, self-denial, self-sacrifice, or evangelism. Men who have something to sell have always wanted men to believe that masculinity can be proved or improved by buying it. In a united tribe with a strong sense of its own identity, there is some harmony between the interests of male groups, and the way of men seems straightforward enough. In a complex, cosmopolitan, individualistic, disunited civilization with many thin, a la carte identities, the way of men is unclear. The ways touted by rich and powerful men are tossed with the ways of gurus and ideologues and jumbled with the macho trinkets of merchants in such a mess that it's easy to see why some say masculinity can mean anything, everything, or nothing at all. Add to that the improvements suggested by women, and the way of men becomes an unreadable map to a junkyard of ideals. To understand who men are, what they have in common, and why men struggle to prove their own worth to each other, reduce male groups to their nucleic form. Sprawling, complex civilizations made up of millions of people are relatively new to men. For most of their time on this planet, men have organized in small survival bands, set against a hostile environment, competing for women and resources with other bands of men. Understanding the way men react to each other demands an understanding of their most basic social unit. Understanding what men want from each other requires an understanding of what men have most often needed from each other, and a sense of how these needs have shaped masculine psychology. Relieved of moral pretense and stripped of folk costumes, the raw masculinity that all men know in their gut has to do with being good at being a man within a small, embattled gang of men struggling to survive. The way of men is the way of that gang.
The Perimeter. You are part of a small human group fighting to stay alive. The reason why doesn't matter. Conquest, war, death, hunger or disease, any of the horsemen will do. You could be our primal ancestors. You could be pioneers. You could be stranded in some remote location. You could be survivors of a nuclear holocaust or the zombie apocalypse. Again, it doesn't matter. For humans without access to advanced technology, the scenario plays out more or less the same way. You have to define your group. You need to define who is in and who is out. And you need to identify potential threats. You need to create and maintain some sort of safe zone around the perimeter of your group. Everyone will have to contribute to the group's survival in some way, unless the group decides to protect and feed someone who can't contribute due to age or illness. For those who can work, you'll need to decide who does what, based on what they are good at, who works well together, and what makes the most practical sense. Hunting and fighting. Hunting and fighting are two of the most dangerous jobs you'll need to do to stay alive. To thrive, humans need protein and fat. You can get enough protein and fat from vegetables, but without an established farm, you're going to be hard-pressed to gather enough vegetables to meet your nutritional needs. A large animal can provide protein and fat for days, longer if you know how to preserve the meat. The problem with big, protein-rich animals is that they don't want to die. Meat is muscle, and muscles make animals strong, often stronger than men. Wild beasts come equipped with tusks, antlers, hooves, claws, and sharp teeth. They're going to fight for their lives. Taking down a big, protein-rich animal is going to be dangerous. It will require strength, courage, technique, and teamwork. Finding food also requires exploring, venturing out into the unknown. And who knows what lurks out there? If you are going to survive, your group will need protection from predators, animal, human, alien, or undead. If there is someone or something out there who wants what you have and is willing to fight for it, you're going to need to figure out who in your group is going to be willing to fight back. You'll want the people who are best at fighting to stand watch, to defend everything you care about, or to go out and eliminate a potential threat. If someone or something has something that you need, the best way to get it may be to take it. Who in your group will be willing and able to do that? Maybe females are part of your group. Maybe they aren't. If females are with you, they won't have access to reliable birth control. Males and females won't stop having sex, and females will get pregnant. Humans are mammals, and like most mammals, a greater part of the reproductive burden will fall on females. That's not fair, but nature isn't fair. Even strong, aggressive women will become more vulnerable and less mobile during pregnancy. Even tough women will nurse their young. They'll bond with their offspring and take to caring for them quickly. Babies are helpless, and children are vulnerable for years. If there were no other physical or mental differences between women and men, in a hostile environment, the biological realities of human reproduction would still mean that over time, more men would be charged with exploring, hunting, fighting, building, and defending. Men would have more time to specialize and develop the necessary skills to excel at those tasks. They wouldn't have a good excuse not to. Men will never get pregnant. They will never be nursing, and they will be less encumbered by their children. They may not even know who their children are. Women know who their kids are. Children don't depend on their fathers in the same way that they depend on their mothers. Men are freer to take risks for the good of the group, believing that their offspring will live on. As things are, there are biological differences between men and women that have little to do with pregnancy or breastfeeding. On average, men are bigger and stronger than women. Men are more daring, probably more mechanically inclined, and generally better at navigating. Men are hardwired for aggressive play. High testosterone men take more risks and seek more thrills. Men are more interested in competing for status, and when they win, their bodies give them a dopamine high and more testosterone. Because your group is struggling to survive, every choice matters. If you give the wrong person the wrong job, that person could die, you could die, another person could die, or you could all die. Because of the differences between the sexes, the best person for jobs that involve exploring, hunting, fighting, building, or defending is usually going to be a male. This is not some arbitrary cultural prejudice. It is the kind of vital strategic discrimination that will keep your group alive. Humans, like chimpanzees, will often hunt in teams because cooperative hunting is more effective than hunting alone. When you put together a team, any kind of team, the raw skills of your candidates aren't the only factors you have to consider. You have to consider the team's social dynamic. Which people will work best together? As a leader, you want to create synergy, reduce distractions, and avoid conflicts within the group. Males will compete for status within any group, but they will also compete for females. Eliminating a second layer of potential jealousy and antagonism may be reason enough to choose a male over a female. If there are females in your group, They will have plenty of hard and necessary work to do. Everyone will have to pull their own weight, but the hunting and fighting is almost always going to be up to the men. When lives are on the line, people will drop the etiquette of equality and make that decision again and again because it makes the most sense. That practical division of labor is where the male world begins. The party gang. Thomas Hobbes wrote that when men live without fear of a common power, they live in a state of war. In war, every man is against every other man. Hobbes' idea of war is interesting on a theoretical level, but his war of all against all is not the state of nature for men. It's natural for a man to look after his own interests, but those interests drive men together, quickly. A loner has no one to ask for help, no one to watch his back, no one to guard him when he sleeps. Men have a greater chance of survival together than they do apart. Men have always hunted and fought in small teams. The natural state of war is ongoing conflict between small gangs of men. Chimpanzees organize on a party gang basis, which means they change the size of their groups depending on the circumstances. Chimps gather together in large parties and build alliances for strategic reasons, for mating, and for the sharing of resources. When circumstances change, they break into smaller groups and hunting parties. The smaller groups, the gangs, are the tightest and most stable. The males are loyal and rarely move from gang to gang. Females sometimes join the males in hunting activities, but they are more likely to move from one gang to another over time. Men organize the same way. For example, take military units. An army is 80,000 to 200,000 members. A corps is 20,000 to 45,000 members. A division is 10,000 to 15,000 members. A brigade is 3,000 to 5,000 members. A regiment is 3,000 to 5,000 members. A battalion is 300 to 1,300 members. A company is 80 to 225 members. A platoon is 26 to 55 members. A section, patrol, or squad is 8 to 13 members. A fire team is 2 to 4 members. All of the men in a given army are part of the same big team, but the strength of the bonds between men will increase as the size of the unit decreases. In smaller groups, men are more loyal to one another. When writer Sebastian Junger asked U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan about their allegiances, they told him that, quote, "They would unhesitatingly risk their lives for anyone in the platoon or company." But that sentiment dropped off pretty quickly after that. By the time you got to brigade level, 3,000 or 4,000 men, any sense of common goals or identity was pretty much theoretical. End quote. There is frequently rivalry between the groups. Each group has its own regalia, its own traditions, its own symbolism, and a common history. Some researchers believe that the human brain can only process enough information to maintain meaningful relationships with 150 or so people at any given time. That's about the size of a military company, but also about the size of a typical primitive human tribe, and roughly the number of friends most people contact regularly through social networking sites. Within that tribe of 150, people form even smaller groups. How many people would you loan a lot of money to? How many people could you depend on in an emergency? How many people could depend on you? If you're like most, the number drops to the size of a platoon, a squad, or even a fire team. The team size for most group sports is somewhere between the fire team number and the platoon number. American football teams have around 50 members on the roster, but only 11 are on the field at any one time. Baseball teams keep 25 members on the rosters, but with 9 on the field. Soccer teams play between 7 and 11 members. Basketball teams play 5. Water polo teams put 7 in the pool. Men revert back to this archetypal gang size, even for recreation and storytelling. How many main characters are there in your favorite films, books, or television shows? The number works for religion and myth, too. Jesus had 12 apostles. How many Greek gods can you name? Norse? The group of 2 to 15 men is a comfort zone. It's an effective team size for tactical maneuvers, but it's also socially manageable. You can really know about that many guys at one time. You can maintain a good working relationship and a meaningful social history with 100 or so more. Beyond those numbers, connections become extremely superficial. Trust breaks down, and more rules and codes, always enforced by the threat of violence, are required to keep men together. In times of stress, when resources are scarce, when the system of rules and codes breaks down, when there is a lapse in enforcement, or when men have little to lose and more to gain by breaking the law, it is the way of men to break off from large parties and operate in small, nimble gangs. The fire team to platoon-sized gang is the smallest unit of us. Beyond us is them, and the line that separates us from them is a circle of trust. Drawing the perimeter. The first job of men in dire times has always been to establish and secure the perimeter. Imagine yourself again in our survival scenario. People can't hunt and fight and kill all day and all night forever. Humans have to sleep, and they have to eat, and they need some downtime. You need to create a safe space and set up camp somewhere. You'll also have to identify some desirable resources, like access to water and food. One of the first things you have to consider is whether the spot makes you vulnerable to attack from predators or unknown groups of men. Then you do some basic recon. You check out the surrounding area to see if there is evidence of another tribe or undesirable beasts. Tired and satisfied, you and your pals set up a base camp and keep an eye on a rudimentary perimeter. The survival of your group will depend on your ability to successfully claim land and keep it safe. When you claim territory and draw a perimeter, that line separates your group from the rest of the world. The people inside the perimeter become us, and everything known and unknown outside the perimeter becomes them. Beyond the light of your night fire, there is darkness. They lie just beyond the flicker of your fire, out there in the dark. They could be wild animals, zombies, killer robots, or dragons. They could also be other men. Men know what men need and what they want. If your men have something that men want or need, you'll have to be wary of other men. The things that have value to men, tools, food, water, women, livestock, shelter, or even good land, will have to be protected from other men who might be desperate enough to harm you to get those things. The perimeter separates men you trust from men you don't trust, or don't know well enough to trust. People like to make friends. Being on the defensive all the time is stressful. Most people want to trust other people. Most people want to be able to relax. If you are smart, until you know them, they will remain out there on the other side of the perimeter. Even if you let your guard down to cooperate or trade with them, they may or may not be absorbed into us. As long as the other men maintain separate identities, there is always the chance that they will choose to put the interests of their own ahead of your interests. In hard times, agreements between groups of men fall apart. Competition creates animosity, and men will dehumanize each other to make the tough decisions necessary for their own group to survive. If you put males together for a short period of time and give them something to compete for, they will form a team of us versus them. This was famously illustrated by Muzaffar Sharif's Robber's Cave experiment. Social psychologists separated two groups of boys and forced them to compete. Each group of boys created a sense of us based on what they liked about themselves or how they wanted to imagine themselves. They also created negative caricatures of the other group. The groups became hostile toward each other. However, when the researchers gave them a good enough reason to cooperate, the competing gangs were able to put aside their differences and join together in a larger party. It has always been the job of men to draw the perimeter, to establish a safe space, to separate us from them, and create a circle of trust. The discovery of new land in the Americas made it possible for men to do this again in recent human history. Small groups of men ventured out into unknown territory because they believed that they had more to gain from risk than they could expect to gain through established channels in the old world. They braved the wild, set up camps, and reinvented civilization as the rest of the world looked on. Out there in the dark, there were Indians, bears, snakes, and other gangs of men willing to use violence to take whatever they wanted. Both the settlers and the natives were men under siege. They had to harden themselves against external forces. They had to decide who they could trust, who they couldn't, and what they needed from the men around them. The story of the American West is only one story. How many gangs, families, tribes, and nations have been founded by a small group of men who struck out on their own, claimed land, defended it, made it safe, and put down roots? If men had never done this, there would not be people living on every continent today. A role apart. You've decided who is in and who is out. You've decided who you trust and who you don't. You are watching the perimeter, protecting what is inside the circle of flickering light, defending everything that means anything to you and the men who stand with you. It all comes down to you, the guardians, because you know that if you fail at your jobs, there can be no human happiness, no family life, no storytelling, no art or music. Your role at the bloody edges of the boundary between us and them supersedes any role you have within the protected space. Yours is a role apart, and your value to other men who share that responsibility will be determined by how well you are willing and able to fulfill that role. Other men will need to know that they can depend on you because everything matters, and your weakness, fear, or incompetence could get any one of them killed or threaten the whole group. Men who are good at this job, men who are good at the job of being men, will earn the respect and trust of the group. Those men will be honored and treated better than men who are disloyal or undependable. The men who deliver victory at moments of greatest peril will attain the highest status among men. They will be treated like heroes, and other men, especially young men, will emulate them. In a complex society, almost all of us live deep within the perimeter. We create our own circles and cliques, and we defend them metaphorically. We include people or exclude them for all kinds of reasons. Far from any boundary between threat and safety, people celebrate qualities that have almost nothing to do with survival. The flock bleats for singers, designers, smooth talkers, and people whose only talents are being witty or pretty. The shepherds drive them round to more of the same. When men evaluate each other as men, they still look for the same virtues that they'd need to keep the perimeter. Men respond to and admire the qualities that would make men useful and dependable in an emergency. Men have always had a role apart, and they still judge one another according to the demands of that role as a guardian in a gang struggling for survival against encroaching doom. Everything that is specifically about being a man, not merely a person, has to do with that role. As you stand back to back, fending off incoming oblivion, what do you need from the men in your group? As you close a circle tighter around dangerous game that could feed you all for a week, what kind of men do you want at your flank?
The Tactical Virtues. Vir is the Latin word for man. The word virtue comes from the Latin virtus. To the early Romans, virtus meant manliness, and manliness meant martial valor. Demonstrating virtus meant showing strength and courage and loyalty while attacking or defending against the enemies of Rome. As the Romans became more successful and their civilization became more complex, it was no longer necessary for all men to hunt or fight. The fighting happened at the edge of the perimeter, and the fighting edge of Roman civilization moved outward. For men deep inside the circle, manliness became increasingly metaphorical. Men who did other work could satisfy their need to be seen as men among men by fighting metaphorically, showing social courage, mastering their desires, and behaving ethically. The meaning of the word virtus and the Roman idea of manliness expanded to include values that were not merely survival virtues, but also civic and moral virtues. Definitions of manliness expand to include other virtues as civilizations grow. However, these other virtues are less specific to men than the fighting virtues, and they vary more from culture to culture. Civilized virtue is about being a good person, a good citizen, a good member of a particular society. Manly virtues should be virtues directly related to manhood. The virtues that men all over the world recognize as manly virtues are the fighting virtues. Epics and action movies translate well because they appeal to something basic to the male condition. A desire to struggle and win, to fight for something, to fight for survival, to demonstrate your worthiness to other men. The virtues specifically associated with being a man outline a rugged philosophy of living, a way to be that is also a strategy for prevailing in dire and dangerous times. The way of men is a tactical ethos. If you are fighting to stay alive and you are surrounded by potential threats, what do you need from the men fighting with you? What do you need from us to fend off them? If eating means facing danger together, who do you want to take with you? What virtues do you need to cultivate in yourself and in the men around you to be successful at the job of hunting and fighting? When your life and the lives of people that you care about depend on it, you'll need the men around you to be as strong as they can be. Living without the aid of advanced technology requires strong backs and elbow grease. You'll need strong men to fight off other strong men. You won't want the men in your gang to be reckless, but you'll need them to be courageous when it matters. A man who runs when the group needs him to fight could put all of your lives in jeopardy. You'll want men who are competent, who can get the job done, who wants to be surrounded by morons and fuck-ups. The men who hunt and fight will have to demonstrate mastery of the skills that your group uses to hunt and fight. A little inventiveness couldn't hurt either. You'll also need your men to commit. You will want to know that the men beside you are us and not them. You'll need to be able to count on them in times of crisis. You want guys who have your back. Men who don't care about what the other men think of them aren't dependable or trustworthy. If you're smart, you will want the other men to prove that they are committed to the team. You'll want them to show that they care about their reputation within the gang, and you'll want them to show that they care about your gang's reputation with other gangs. Strength, courage, mastery, and honor. These are the practical virtues of men who must rely on one another in a worst-case scenario. Strength, courage, mastery, and honor are simple, functional virtues. They are the virtues of men who must answer to their brothers first, whether their brothers are good or unscrupulous men. These tactical virtues point to triumph. They are amoral, but not immoral. Their morality is primal, and it lives in a closed circle. The tactical virtues are unconcerned with abstract moral questions of universal right or wrong. What is right is what wins, and what is wrong is what loses, because losing is death and the end of everything that matters. Strength, courage, mastery, and honor are the virtues that protect the perimeter. They are the virtues that save us. They are the virtues that men need to protect their interests, and also the virtues that they must develop to go after what they want. They are the virtues of the defender and the attacker. Strength, courage, mastery, and honor belong to no one god, though many gods claim them. Whatever men fight for, strength, courage, mastery, and honor are what they must demand of each other if they are going to win. Strength, courage, mastery, and honor are the alpha virtues of men all over the world. They are the fundamental virtues of men because without them, no higher virtues can be entertained. You need to be alive to philosophize. You can add to these virtues, and you can create rules and moral codes to govern them. But if you remove them from the equation altogether, you aren't just leaving behind the virtues that are specific to men. You are abandoning the virtues that make civilization possible. The men who are strong, courageous, competent, and loyal will be respected and honored as valuable members of Team us. Men who are exceptionally weak or fearful can't be counted on. Men who are inept in some important way must either find a way to compensate, and they will try if they are loyal and honorable, if they want to help with the hunting and fighting, or they will find other work to do in the tribe. A man of questionable loyalty who doesn't seem to care what the other men think of him or how their tribe is perceived will not be trusted by the hunting and fighting gang. Men who are not up to the job of fulfilling the first role of men for one or all of these reasons will be pushed out of the hunting and fighting group and sent to work with the women, the children, the sick, and the elderly. Men have different drives, aptitudes, and temperaments. Most men have the ability to adapt to the hunting and fighting role, to life at the edge of the perimeter, but some men won't cut it. They will be regarded as less manly and thought of as lesser men. Some men are going to get their feelings hurt. That's not fair, but fairness is a luxury that men can ill afford in dire times. Men who want to avoid being rejected by the gang will work hard and compete with each other to gain the respect of the male gang. Men who are stronger, more courageous, and more competent by nature will compete with each other for higher status within that group. As long as there is something to be gained by achieving a higher position within the gang, whether it is greater control, greater access to resources, or just pure esteem and the comfort of being higher in the hierarchy than the guys at the bottom, men will compete against each other for a higher position. However, because humans are cooperative hunters, the party gang principle scales down to the individual level. Just as groups of men will compete against each other, but unite if they believe that more can be gained through cooperation, individual men will compete within a gang when there is no major external threat, but then put aside their differences for the good of the group. Men aren't wired to fight or cooperate. They are wired to fight and cooperate. Understanding this ability to perceive and prioritize different levels of conflict is essential to understanding the way of men and the four tactical virtues. Men will constantly shift gears from in-group competition to competition between groups or competition against an external threat. It is good to be stronger than other men within your gang, but it is also important for your gang to be stronger than another gang. Men will challenge their comrades and test each other's courage, but in many ways, this intra-group challenging prepares men to face inter-group competition. Just as it is important for men to show their peers that they won't be pushed around, the survival of a group can depend on whether or not they are willing to push back against other groups to protect their own interests. Men love to show off new skills and find ways to best their pals, but mastery of many of the same skills will be crucial in battles with nature and other men. The sports and games that men play most demand the kind of strategic thinking and/or physical virtuosity that would be required in a survival struggle. A man's reputation may stop men in his group from messing with him too much, and a group's reputation may make its enemies think twice about creating animosity. Sociologists and street gang experts typically write about an excessive concern with reputation or a desire to avenge disses with confused, haughty contempt. But the truth is that men have behaved this way for most of human history, and the strategic reasons why should be obvious to anyone who doesn't feel he can rely on police protection. If no one is coming to save you, you'd better be tough or look tough, and you'll probably want some tough guys ready and willing to get your back. I have no idea how people manage to be confused about something that simple and obvious, but I'm pretty sure our ancestors would have killed them and taken their stuff. The next four chapters will elaborate on what I mean by strength, courage, mastery, and honor. These simple words have many meanings, and they mean different things to different people. The manly virtues represent concepts so universally appealing that even the weak, cowardly, inept, and dishonorable struggle to find ways in which they, too, can feel like they embody these virtues. With each of the four, I will show why they relate specifically to men, how women fit into the picture, and how the virtues relate to each other. After we have examined each of the tactical virtues and considered them amorally, I'll address the issues of morality and ethics again, and explain what I think the difference is between being a good man and being good at being a man, and why they're not the same thing.
Strength. If you take a thing apart, or modify it, there are certain aspects which must remain intact, or be replaced, for it to retain its identity. Without certain parts, it becomes something else. Without strength, masculinity becomes something else, a different concept. Strength is not an arbitrary value assigned to men by human cultures. Increased strength is one of the fundamental biological differences between males and females. Aside from basic reproductive plumbing, greater strength is one of the most prominent, historically consequential, and consistently measurable physical differences between males and females. It is fashionable today to put the word weaker in quotations to avoid offending women when they are referred to as the weaker sex. Quotation marks will not alter the basic human truth that men are still on average significantly physically stronger than women. Serious people should be able to admit that something is generally true when it is a verifiable fact. There is no good reason to be coy about it. Strength isn't the only quality that matters. Sometimes it doesn't matter at all. Strength is rarely a disadvantage. However, in our mechanically assisted modern world, physical strength is often less consequential than it used to be. Of consequence or not, it is what it is. Women can demonstrate strength, but strength is a quality that defines masculinity. Greater strength differentiates men from women. Weak men are regarded as less manly, but no one really cares or notices if a woman is physically weaker than her peers. In a way, this is truer, or truer across classes, than it ever has been. Women living on farms or in primitive hunter-gatherer societies were expected to do far more demanding physical labor than any work required of the average woman today. We admire strength in female athletes, but a beautiful woman who can't lift a bag of groceries will still have many admirers, and plenty of men will be willing to help her carry her groceries. Many female celebrities who are considered beautiful by both men and women are so thin that they look starved and brittle. Collectively, we don't care whether a woman is strong or not. A woman is not considered less womanly if she is physically weak. Many may consider a woman less womanly if she is too strong. Specifically, a woman tends to look more like a man if she has conspicuously high level of muscle mass and unusually low body fat. Precisely because of the physiological differences between males and females, only the most dedicated and disciplined female bodybuilders ever managed to look like He-Man action figures with Barbie doll heads. Average women who train with weights will increase strength and overall health, but most will still look like women. Testosterone may or may not play an important role in female muscular development. However, in men, testosterone, the most recognized androgen, has a complementary relationship with increased strength and muscle mass. Men who have more muscle tend to have and maintain higher testosterone levels. And men who have higher testosterone levels tend to have an easier time getting bigger and stronger. Men who increase their testosterone levels, either through training and diet or via artificial means, tend to look more masculine. Put differently, men with more muscle look less like most women and more like the least androgynous men. This has absolutely nothing to do with culture. There is no human culture where men who are weak are considered manlier, while women who are more muscular are considered more womanly. The importance of human strength varies from society to society, usually in some relationship to available technologies and the kind of work that is required of average people. But strength has been a masculinity-defining quality, always and everywhere. If we are making an honest attempt to understand and define masculinity or manliness as that which pertains to or is characteristic of men, physical strength must figure prominently in that definition. The way of men is the way of the strong, or at least the stronger. As I and many others have mentioned, strength is not always a great advantage in the modern world. However, if we go back to our primal gang, our band of brothers fighting for survival, the value of strength to the group increases substantially. Where there is work and fighting to be done, the advantages of being stronger are obvious. A man who can hit twice as hard is also, other variables aside, worth more to the gang. In addition to giving a man the ability to take a position of greater prominence in a gang, strength made him more valuable overall. A man who can carry twice as much as another man, other variables aside, is worth more to the gang. One evolutionary biologist recently suggested that humans stood up because standing up gave human males a greater mechanical advantage when clobbering each other. They may have started walking upright for other reasons as well. On a long enough timeline, both A and B is a reasonable explanation if both explanations are reasonable. As a natural advantage, pummeling power matters. It is also generally believed that fighting is one of the reasons why males have greater upper body strength than females. In the primal gang, the man who is substantially stronger than all of his peers is a juggernaut, capable of crushing anyone in his path. He is capable of exerting his will in any way that he sees fit. The will itself is our second manly virtue. Strength, in the strictest physical sense, is the muscular ability to exert pressure. Putting aside the workings of involuntary muscles, for conscious beings, strength is the ability to exert force in accordance with one's will. This can be as simple as forcing one bone toward another and releasing it. A certain amount of strength is required to wiggle your finger. Strength is an aptitude. Strength is an ability that can be developed, but as with intelligence, most people will have a certain natural range of potential beyond which they will be unable to progress. Some individuals will have a greater aptitude for developing strength than others. Humans are unequal in their aptitudes. This is one of the cruel but fundamental truths of human life. It takes a certain amount of strength to reach for a piece of fruit and yank it away from a plant. Strength is required to build and to farm and to hunt and to carry groceries from the store and put them in your car. Ask an old person if a loss of strength has impacted their lives in a negative or positive way. A weaker person is more vulnerable. Less strength means it is less likely you will be able to push someone away who wants to take something from you. And on a strictly physical level, reduced strength means a diminished ability to take what you want from someone else. A person who is too weak simply cannot survive. It is strength that makes all other values possible. Strength is the ability to exert one's will over oneself, over nature, and over other people. As we move from the dire circumstances of the survival gang to luxurious life in a civilized society, the concept of strength doesn't change so much as it expands and becomes a metaphor. The word strength can describe a wide range of abilities and powers without losing its primal meaning or cachet. Strength is the corporeal equivalent of power. Strength is having 300 tanks to use against your enemy's 200 tanks. Strength is the arsenal, but no guarantee that the arsenal will be used. Strength, in this broader sense, is a desirable commodity. Getting stronger, increasing strength, means increasing your ability as an individual, a gang, or a nation to do as you wish with relative impunity. What is freedom, if not the ability to do what one wishes? Strength is the ability to move, and greater strength moves more. However, just as muscles can make isometric contractions, strength can also be the ability to stand against outside pressure. Strength is also the ability to hold fast, a tattoo once found on the knuckles of sailors whose lives, and the lives of the gang of men on their ship, depended on their ability to hold on and weather a storm. That strength means both the ability to move and the ability to become immovable is no more a contradiction than the mechanics of a muscle are a contradiction. Physical strength is the defining metaphor of manhood because strength is a defining characteristic of men. An increased aptitude for physical strength differentiates most males from most women, and this difference, though less important in times of safety and plenty, has defined the role of men for all of human history. Strength can be put to a variety of uses, but when it is put to no use, it is like a powerful engine, collecting dust in a garage or a beautiful singing voice that no one ever hears. A sports car that never puts rubber to the road is just a pretty hunk of metal. To experience the joy of his natural talent, a singer must sing. The experience of being male is the experience of having greater strength, and strength must be exercised and demonstrated to be of any worth. When men will not, or cannot, exercise their strength or put it to use, strength is decorative and worthless.
Courage.
Strength is a straightforward physical concept. Courage has many names and has been defined in many ways. Strength is the ability to move or stand against external forces. Courage is kinetic. Courage initiates movement, action, or fortitude. Courage exercises strength. The cowardly lion, the tough-looking guy who stands aside as weaker men fight the fight, take the risks, and do the work, is worth less than the men who step into the arena. I will not claim that all exertions of will are courageous, but all acts which require courage are exertions of will. It does not take courage to use strength to pick up a glass and lift it to your mouth. Courage implies risk. It implies a potential for failure or the presence of danger. Courage is measured against danger. The greater the danger, the greater the courage. Running into a burning building beats telling off your boss. Telling off your boss is more courageous than writing a really mean anonymous note. Acts without meaningful consequences require little courage. Aristotle believed that courage was concerned with fear, and that while there were many things to fear in life, death was the most fearful thing of all. In his Nicomachean Ethics, the brave man is a man who, quote, is fearless in the face of noble death and all of the emergencies that involve death, and the emergencies of war are in the highest degree of this kind, end quote. He also made the point that men who are forced to fight are less courageous than those who demonstrate courage in battle of their own free will. Aristotle framed courage as a moral virtue, as a will to noble action. He questioned the courage of those who are confident due to success in battle, though I wonder how such success can be earned except through some initial show of courage. While it is true that the chests of strong and experienced men often swell when threats are minor, and such men have been known to back down in the face of a legitimate challenge, a certain amount of courage is the product of a successful record. Is a man who has never won a fight more courageous for taking on an experienced fighter, no matter how noble the cause, or is he simply a fool? Aristotle's mean of courage is not the wild, rash confidence of a passionate man who fights in the heat of the moment out of fear or anger. Rather, he suggests that, quote, brave men act for honor's sake, but passion aids them, unquote. He does allow that men who act from strength of feeling possess, quote, something akin to courage, end quote. Aristotle's formulation of courage, while admirable, is so conditional and lashed to a slippery, high-minded ideal of noble action that trying to determine who is truly courageous becomes a bit of a game. Andrea, the word Aristotle used for courage, was also synonymous with manliness in ancient Greece. Andrea is derived from andros, which connotes male or masculine. In his book Roman Manliness, classicist Miles MacDonald argued that the word virtus, which, quote, struck the ear of an ancient Roman much as manliness does that of an English speaker, unquote, meant courage, specifically in battle, in pre-classical Latin. The word vir meant man, and virtus meant courage. MacDonald wrote, quote, in military contexts, virtus can denote the kind of courage required to defend the homeland, but more often, it designates aggressive conduct in battle. In non-military situations, courageous virtus usually refers to the capacity to face and endure pain and death, end quote. Courageous manliness is personified in the story of Gaius Mucius, a noble Roman youth from the early Republic. An Etruscan king named Porsenna had besieged Rome by garrisoning his soldiers around the city. Gaius Mucius asked the Roman senators for permission to slip into the Etruscan camp and kill Porsenna. He killed Porsenna's secretary by mistake, and he was captured by the king's bodyguards. Gaius Mucius said to the king, quote, I am Gaius Mucius, a citizen of Rome. I came here as an enemy to kill my enemy, and I am as ready to die as I am to kill. We Romans act bravely, and when adversity strikes, we suffer bravely. Nor am I the only one who feels this way. Behind me stands a line of those who seek the same honor. End quote. Porsenna threatened to throw Gaius Mucius into the fire. Gaius Mucius responded by thrusting his own hand into the fire. As his hand burned, he said, quote, look upon me and realize what a paltry thing the body is for those who seek great glory. End quote. Porsenna told Gaius Mucius that were he a member of his own tribe, he would commend him for his bravery. Gaius Mucius was released, but he told Porsenna that there were 300 other Romans who would be willing to sacrifice themselves as he had to save their city, and that if the siege of Rome persisted, sooner or later, one of them would manage to succeed in killing the king. Porsenna sent an envoy to the Romans, offering peace terms. Gaius Mucius earned the nickname Scaevola, meaning left-handed, after losing his right hand to the fire. For both Aristotle and the Romans, courage and manliness was the will to heroically risk life and limb against a